Welcome to the 68th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series entitled End as Beginning, Chinese Art and Dynastic Time, art historian Wu Hong explores the narratives of Chinese art and their relationship to artistic production while reflecting on a series of questions. How did dynastic time emerge and permeate writings on traditional Chinese art? How did it enrich and redefine itself in specific historical contexts? How did it interact with temporalities in different historical, religious, and political systems? How did narratives based on dynastic time respond to and inspire artistic creation? In the first lecture, The Emergence of Dynastic Time in Chinese Art, delivered on March 31st, 2019, Wu Hong begins by introducing the concept of dynastic time and its sustained role in narrating the history of Chinese art, then traces this narrative mode to the 4th century BCE, when a body of texts associated visual and material forms with a succession of archaic dynasties.
I want to first briefly explain the background of this lecture series. Last year, I gave a talk at the College Art Association's annual conference titled Chinese Art History as a Global Art History. I told the audience that although China has a long tradition of art historical writing, producing the first comprehensive painting history as early as the 9th century. But the modern field of Chinese art history, either in China or elsewhere, didn't naturally grow out of this pre-modern tradition. Instead, it emerged as a part of a sweeping global modernization movement in the 19th and 20th centuries, which reorganized local knowledge into supposedly universal systems of disciplines. The idea of art history as a humanistic discipline was introduced to China in the early 20th century, where it gave birth to a new kind of art historical writing that instantly delegitimized the old-fashioned literary discourse on art. Such a breakaway from tradition was possible because China was then undergoing a profound transformation into a modern nation-state. Reformist intellectuals not only adopted Enlightenment ideology to reshape China's social-political system, but also strived to rewrite the country's cultural history based on scientific models provided by Europe and Japan. Art history, or Meishushi in Chinese, entered Chinese language in 1911, very precise date, and became a required course in teacher training schools next year, in 1912, the year of the Republican Revolution. So it's a very interesting coincidence. Revolution, Republican Revolution, and the beginning of this modern art history in China. Unlike traditional Chinese scholarship on art, which focused exclusively on painting and calligraphy, this modern art history significantly broadened the scope of art to include sculpture and architecture, religious icons and the temple murals, tombs and mortuary artifacts, and the various kinds of crafts. The concepts of formal beauty and the stylistic evolution prevailed in telling this new story of Chinese art. Since that time, about 100 years ago, generations of scholars have made numerous contributions to substantiate this new discipline, especially from the 1980s, with the ending of the Cold War and China's new open-door policy, historians of Chinese art around the world were finally able to converge and share research materials and interests, where scholarly publications, archaeological information, and exhibitions circulated beyond the national borders. Such exchanges had an instant impact on Western scholarship on Chinese art, as demonstrated by the many groundbreaking English publications since the 1980s. On the other side of the Pacific Ocean, the Institute of Art History was established in Taipei in 1990, providing another crucial venue to connect the different scholarly traditions on Chinese art. In mainland China, the field of art history started to expand rapidly after the 1990s. Since then, it has produced an astonishing amount of books and articles. Its appeal to students and young scholars keeps growing. So speaking in 2018 or 2019, I no longer see a clear distinction between so-called Western and Chinese scholarship on Chinese art. Differences in language, readership, and academic environment certainly exist. But the global collaboration and mutual learning has become the dominant trend. This progress, on the other hand, has also confronted historians of Chinese art with new challenges. Some of these challenges are more recent, such as how to integrate the linear regional approach of Chinese art history into a more three-dimensional global art history. That's a relatively new challenge. Other challenges have always been there, but have remained secondary to the effort to modernize the field. One challenge of this second kind is to re-examine key concepts currently used in writing about Chinese art, which are mostly loanwords derived from the study of European art. Here I'm talking about concepts as basic as image, iconography, style, representation, gaze, monuments, narrative, evolution, and many, many others. These are all from Western languages. While these concepts have facilitated modern scholarship on Chinese art history, their adaptation was not based on firsthand research of China's art historical reality. I should emphasize that I'm not in any way advocating replacing them with traditional Chinese terms. Rather, I hope that new research on Chinese art will simultaneously reflect on this universal concept vis-a-vis indigenous art practice and discourse, and will in this process redefine this concept or expand their meaning. Such integrated historical and theoretical project will in turn encourage comparative studies that will become the basis of a true global art history. This brings me to the theme of this lecture series, Chinese art and the dynastic time. At the center of my lectures will be how Chinese art was narrated historically in its original culture, social, political, and artistic contexts. To tackle this question, I believe we need to investigate the interactions between art practices and historical discourses on art. Art practices encompass everything related to the creation, presentation, and circulation of works of art. historical discourses on art embrace all the sorts of writings produced in the same cultural milieu that describe and interpret art practices, including history, mythology, philosophy, ritual prescription, hagiography, as well as art historical scholarship. It doesn't take much effort to realize that the most powerful and lasting narrative framework of Chinese art has been dynastic time, which organized historical information and channeled the historical imagination through successive dynasties from the 3rd millennium BC to the 21st century CE. As I will explain later in this lecture, this narrative first emerged around the 4th century BCE. 1200 years later, when Zhang Yanyuan wrote the first comprehensive narrative of Chinese art in the 9th century, he explicitly titled this history Famous Painting of Successive Dynasties. The same mode of dynastic time still dominates our understanding of Chinese art history today. A glance at the tables of contents in current introductions to Chinese art immediately reveal this fact. On the screen is the table of contents of Michael Sullivan's very popular book, Art of China, now in its 6th edition. Its 12 chapters, as you can see, start from before the dawn of history and progresses through various dynasties: the Shang, Zhou, Qin, Han, Tang, Song, Yuan, Ming, Qing, till the 20th century. By folding the 20th century into this structure, these and similar textbooks implicitly incorporate modern and contemporary art into a linear narrative based on dynastic time. So deep-rooted is this temporal order in Chinese art history that it seems to have become self-evident and natural as a priori and a shared chronology that escapes historical scrutiny. As a result, although the field of Chinese art produces huge quantities of research every year, there has been very little reflection on the nature of this temporal framework and its role in both the discourse and the practice of Chinese art. My inquiry into the narrative Chinese art thus acquires a sharp focus, i.e., the nature of dynastic time and its role in shaping the history of Chinese art. As proposed earlier, the symbiotic relationships between practice and discourse will be the focus of my reflection. Many questions will arise along this line of inquiry. For example, how did dynastic time emerge in the discourse on art and infiltrate contemporaneous art practice? This is the topic of today's lecture. How did this narrative mode constantly redefine itself in changing historical contexts? How did it interact with other temporalities of divergent historical, religious, and political systems? How did the historical narratives based on dynastic time both respond to and inspire artistic creation? As these questions indicate, these lectures perceive the history of Chinese art not as a retrospective reconstruction, but as an evolving process, which fosters its concept and vocabulary alongside the invention of artworks, mediums, and styles, not after such inventions. Today's lecture initiates this discussion by connecting two previously, I believe, overlooked phenomena in Chinese art around the 4th century BCE. The first took place in the realm of textual production. A body of texts on mortuary rites begin to associate past visual and material forms, whether real or imagined, with a succession of archaic dynasties. Around the same time, there also emerged a new system of objects, as demonstrated by recent archaeological exhibitions. In exploring the relationship between these two phenomena, I need to first explain the concept of Sun Dai, or the Three Dynasties, the earliest verbal expression of dynastic time related to art. I will then turn to concrete objects, primarily from King Cuo's tomb, from the state of Zhongshan, one of the greatest archaeological discoveries ever in China. This tomb yielded areas of objects made of surprisingly diverse materials and showing surprisingly diverse artistic styles. Such diversity stops puzzling us once we link it with a contemporary discourse on ritual art and see it as an essential characteristic of an emerging visual system in a transformative period in Chinese history. So let me begin to talk about this first section, the Three Dynasties, as the embodiment of ritual art. All modern introductions to Chinese history include a standard chronological chart like this, listing the successive Chinese dynasties over the past 4,000 years. Most of these charts, however, fail to reflect an up-to-date historiographical approach, which divides these dynasties into two fundamentally different sequences, separated by the Qin dynasty in the 3rd century BCE. The Qin and the subsequent dynasties can be more accurately called imperial dynasties. Each of them was ruled by a line of hereditary emperors who governed China as the Son of Heaven through a vast bureaucratic system until overthrown and replaced by a new dynasty. Dynastic transitions sometimes turned into prolonged periods of divisions during which regional regimes competed for the throne. But eventually, the central dynastic power was reestablished, and the history regained its centrality and straightforward path. That's about second half. It's more like an imperial succession of this kind of dynastic power, starting from Qin dynasty in the 3rd century BCE. The three earliest dynasties on the chronological chart, the Xia, the Shang, and the Zhou, differ from these later centralized imperial powers. Modern historians and anthropologists have demonstrated that they were established by separate kinship groups, which coexist over a long period. This diagram was by the late Professor K.C. Zhang, really introduced this idea very powerfully. This situation resulted from the prehistorical development of Chinese civilization, in which many regional cultures emerged and gradually intermingled to form expanding culture and political complexes. Towards the late 3rd millennium BCE, there arose the three strongest groups in North China. The chronology from the Xia to the Shang and then to the Zhou actually means the alternating dominance of each group from around 2100 to 800 BCE. But even after a kinship group lost its political dominance over the other groups, it still maintained its internal order and religious center to a large degree. This multilinear pattern differs from the linear dynastic succession in later Chinese history. The term Sun Dai, or Three Dynasties, was coined in the late 6th or early 5th century BCE, some 200 years after the fall of the Zhou, or the Western Zhou, as we call it today. The root meaning of Dai, of Sun Dai, is generation. Sun Dai, therefore, analogize the Xia, the Shang, and the Zhou as three past generations of a family. The key person responsible for this historiographical concept was none other than Confucius, who considered a crucial importance of the three dynasties to be their establishment of ritual regulations. Confucius and his followers, who came to be known as the Ru School, or the School of Scholars, believed that these regulations were lost or obscured during the chaos after the Zhou Dynasty's fall, and that it was their mission to recover them because ritual, or Li, provided a foundation for a harmonious society. It is in this spirit they elevated ritual or Li to an almost religious significance. As we read in the Book of Rites, a classic of the Ru School, this word, of all things by which men live, Li, ritual rites, is the greatest. Without Li, there would be no means of regulating the service paid to the spirits of heaven and earth. Without Li, there would be no means of distinguishing the positions of ruler and subject, superior and inferior, old and young. Without Li, there would be no means of maintaining the separate relations between man and woman, father and son, elder and younger brothers, and of conducting the intercourse between families related in marriage and the frequency and infrequency of the cooperation between friends. Li was not a set of abstract principles, but had to be realized through ritual performance and display. The Ru School arose from ritual specialists, and many of Confucian's followers continue to oversee ritual affairs. This professional background explains their reliance on concrete ritual objects to convey social and moral codes. The collective term for ritual objects, or ritual paraphernalia, is Li Qi, understood as a physical object that embody ritual regulations. Two short passages in the Book of Rites highlight this idea. The first reads, I put it there, the round and square food containers of Fu and Gui, the Zhu stand, and the tall dish dough, with their regulated forms and surface decoration, are the qi embodying Li, are the vessels, objects embodying ritual codes. The second passage, very short, supposedly spoken by Confucius himself, consists of only four characters. Qi yi chang li. It is qi that stores Li. Confucius died in 479 BCE. During the next 2.5 centuries, his followers reconstructed imaginary ancient ritual systems, compiled extensive ritual prescriptions, and discoursed on the principles of ritual and the ritual objects in philosophical treatises. Two tendencies in this textual production are closely related to this discussion. One is an intensifying attention to the classification of ritual vessels in accordance with their symbolism and ceremonial functions. Classification. The other is the appearance of a succinct dynastic histories of ritual objects and practices. Here are a few examples of such mini histories from the Tangong chapter in the Book of Rites. I will read two. The first passage is about materiality, in our modern term. So in the time of Shun of Yu, they used earthenware coffins. Under the sovereigns of the Xia dynasty, they surrounded these with an enclosure of bricks. The people of Yin, i.e. the Shang dynasty, used wooden coffins, the outer and inner. The people of the Zhou dynasty added surrounding curtains and the feathery ornaments. So we begin to see this a history, a narrative, very short, but they're guided by dynasties. The second passage is about color. Under the sovereigns of the Xia dynasty, they preferred what was black. Under the Yin, i.e. Shang dynasty, they preferred what was white. Under the Zhou dynasty, they preferred what was red. The third one, longer, I won't read, is about the place, space, locations of a ritual practice. So there is the idea of about material, about color, about the location, and all related to ritual. Although brief, these statements constitute the earliest historical narrative of ritual objects and practices in China. Some of these narratives were likely based on credible knowledge of the past. For example, archaeological excavations have confirmed the development of the coffin from pottery containers to multiple-layered timber caskets, like described in this passage. And unearthed black and white pottery vessels discovered from Longshan sites and Shang tombs, respectively, also match the description of the favorite colors of the Xia and Shang dynasties. Also significant, most of these mini histories of ritual objects and practices were concerned with death, reflecting a profound shift of the center of ancestor worship from lineage temples to the tombs of families and individuals. Against this background, we can now turn to objects from archaeological finds. Second section. The system of ritual objects in King Cuo's mausoleum. Sometime before his death in 309 or 308 BCE, Cuo, king of Zhongshan in North China, commanded his chief minister to design a mausoleum for him and his wife. The order was duly carried out. Two copies of an architecture plan were made, one stored in the royal archives and the other buried with the king after his death. The second copy was discovered in 1977 in a large grave at Pingshan, about 160 miles south of Beijing. Inscriptions and other unearthed objects from tomb identified the tomb occupant as King Cuo. The design of the mausoleum is extravagantly delineated with inlaid gold thread on a bronze plate about 1 meter long and a half a meter wide. Using geometric shapes and abundant inscriptions, the designer detailed the placement and measurement of various components of a double-walled funerary park. An edict is inscribed next to the central square that represents King Cuo's burial, as if projecting the monarch's order from inside the grave. The edict, this short text, records his commission of the mausoleum's design and warns that anyone who fails to follow the design will be executed without remit. Their punishment will extend to their sons and grandsons. In addition to providing the earliest known architecture drawing from ancient China, this diagram of the funerary district, as it is known in archaeological literature, demonstrates the king's seriousness in planning his own burial. We can assume that the same sincerity also governed the tomb's furnishing. The tomb was unfortunately completely destroyed by fire, set probably by ancient robbers after looting it. Looting the central section of the grave. The only part that escaped this disaster are two hidden chambers built on a flat terrace above the grave pit. You can see there at the circle, these are locations of these two hidden chambers. Architectural remains indicate that this terrace, you see a square terrace there, this terrace was constructed as a solemn ritual ground to hold the mortuary rites before and or after the king's interment. Among the numerous objects stored in the two chambers, three groups stand out with their distinct material and decorative styles. So now I will introduce these three groups. The first group consists of two special vessels with long inscriptions. One of them is the largest tripod from the tomb. You see to your left. The other is a unique vase decorated with flamboyant dragons climbing up the four edges. Both vessels are made of pure bronze. Their smooth bodies provide functional surfaces to display long texts. These are, in fact, the longest inscriptions to be discovered on any bronze objects made since the fall of Western Zhou nearly 400, 500 years ago. Both inscriptions are written in a sophisticated literary style full of classical allusions. The calligraphy is superb too. The elegant, well-proportioned characters reflect not only the inscriber's calligraphic training, but also his extraordinary skill in engraving nearly 1,000 characters on hard bronze with such ease and confidence. The inscription on the vase, this one, consists of 450 characters. It starts by identifying the vase, a solemn sacrificial vessel commissioned by King Cuo after defeating the neighboring state of Yan in order to make offerings to God on high and to the former kings of Zhongshan royal house. Cuo then praises his ancestors in the first person and vows to follow their model. The text on the tripod was composed around the same time, Well, it shares the central theme of the vase inscription in glorifying royal ancestors and condemning Yan, it has a stronger autobiographical flavor. In a consistent first-person voice. So in this first-person voice, King Cuo recalls his childhood experience and speaks about his late father and grandfather in a rather intimate manner. Both vessels revive the old practice of dedicating sacrificial bronzes to ancestral deities to commemorate a current event that's defeating the neighboring state, then make this offering to the ancestor. That was a very old practice, but now was revived. This practice, which emerged in the late Shang Dynasty and prevailed in Western Zhou Dynasty, is evoked in a chapter of the Book of Rites, which was, according to some scholars, roughly contemporary to King Zong. So very interesting passage about the meaning of inscription and inscribing. The commissioner of the inscription on a ritual bronze names himself and takes occasion to praise and set forth the excellent qualities of his ancestors, and clearly exhibits them for future generations. By casting such a discourse on ritual vessel, the inscriber makes himself famous and proves that he is entitled to sacrifice to his ancestors. In the celebration of his ancestors, he exalts his filial piety. That he himself appears after them is natural. And in the clear showing of all this to future generations, he is giving instruction. The close affinities between this statement in the Book of Rites and King Cho's inscription are obvious. Indeed, as I will discuss later in this talk, the revival of the Zhongshan tradition in making the two vessels was likely guided by members of the Ru school clique. Dedicated to Cho's deceased predecessors, these vessels would have been kept in the royal ancestral temple to symbolize the continuation of the king's lineage. As such, they would be known as vessels of grave importance, called the Zhongqi, vessels of grave importance, upon which the fate of the state lay. That is the first group, pure bronze, sacrificial vessel, vessel of grave importance, dedicated to ancestors. Okay. The second group of objects, you will be shocked probably, buried in King Cho's tomb consists of beautiful utilitarian objects, among which are two unique lamps. You see that two unique lamps. An excrete table, that's one, the excrete table, and the sculpted stands for a large folding screen. It is no exaggeration to call these objects the most dazzling sculpture and decorative works from the 4th century BCE China. Three essential features of these works are fantastic imagery, intricate design, and a dazzling color effect. A bronze lamp takes the shape of a gigantic tree with individual branches supporting 13 lamp holders. The spiraling dragon climbing the central branch may be the mythological lamp dragon, Zhulong. It's hard to see, but it's here. It's a dragon climbing up to the top. But other images derive their forms from the observed world, singing birds perch on the tree. Here are the birds here, the big birds singing on the tree, and monkeys reach out towards two men who stand under the tree to feed the animals. So the monkeys are here, and there are a lot of monkeys, and here's one man, here standing another. There are feeding the monkeys, yeah. So designer has captured a moment in life and created a lively and delightful atmosphere. A different visual strategy characterizes several other works in this group. Mostly consisting of animal images, they bear intricately inlaid patterns while showing exotic foreign elements. Among these, the square table stand we see here consists of four dragons and four phoenixes, their bodies, wings, and horns all interlock, forming one of the most ingenious interlaced designs from ancient China, maybe one of the most beautiful tables ever made. Scholars have found a foreign influence in some of these animal images, such as the paired mythical beasts whose winged body and the gaping mouth possibly connect them with the West and Central Asian prototypes. While this view is not universally accepted, the central base of the folding screen, which represents a tiger in the act of devouring a deer, almost certainly derived visual elements from the steppes in the north, because its animal combat motif and the emphasis on motion are both trademarks of steppe art, as exemplified by the famous golden plaque in the Siberian collection of Peter the Great, now in the Hermitage Museum. It would be a mistake, however, to view the Zhongshan tiger stand as a direct copy of steppe art. Created in the late 4th century BCE in central China, the object transforms a small combat scene into one on a monumental scale, half a meter long and weighing 26 kilograms. The culture and artistic fusion is also reflected in the creative use of inlay decoration in accentuating the patterns of animal skins. You can see the inlays are used to represent the pattern of skin. Very importantly, none of these beautiful objects bear inscriptions, no commemorative inscriptions. Their lavish ornamentation and the exotic imagery serve to generate an opulent atmosphere in the royal palace. When these utilitarian and luxury items were used to furnish the king's tomb, they became what is classified in Confucian ritual discourse as sheng qi, or lived objects, i.e., objects that had been used by the deceased when he was still alive. To Xunzi, a leading Confucian theorist who lived from the late 4th to early 3rd century BCE, exactly around the same time, I quote, "To furnish a grave with a lived object is to symbolize that the deceased had changed his path of death," right? But only token articles are taken, not all that he used. And though they have their original shape, they are rendered unusable. This last line may explain why in King Tso's tomb, the grand folding screen and a large tent were disassembled, and their disjoint parts placed at different locations in the storage chambers. So by eliminating their functionality, these utilitarian objects were transformed into specific type of tomb furnishing. There is transformation going on. So this is the second group, very different from the first. In the same essay called Discourse on Ritual, Xunzi, that's the Confucian philosopher, Xunzi, mentions yet another type of funerary objects called the Ming Qi, or spirit articles, which, quote, have the shape of real objects but cannot be used. This description leads us to identify a third group of artifacts in King Tso's tomb, consisting of as many as 48 shiny black pottery vessels, with incised and scraped geometric patterns floating faintly on the dark surface. However striking in visual effect, these elegant ceramic objects are actually soft, low-fired wares which cannot be used. Their black surface resulted from a special burning process. Their shapes and the modeling further reinforce their identity as a dysfunctional spirit articles. For example, a picture in the middle has a sharply angular spot in the shape of a duck's head. So there's a capture a little bit. So it's really the definition of the spirit articles in mortuary objects which have the shape of real objects but cannot be used. So here is, I just mentioned, these vessels actually cannot be used because they are low-fired, very soft, they absorb water or liquid, right? And also their shapes also, etc., like this shape. You cannot pour water out here, right? Yeah. And the basin here we see to your right has a central column supporting a sculpted bird in the middle. When displayed in funerary rites, these vessels must have formed a startling visual contrast with the two other kinds of vessels. The sacrificial vessels made of pure bronze and the sacral utensils with colorful inlaid surfaces. In Confucian ritual texts, spirit vessels, the black one, are also called ghost vessels. Ghost vessels. The contrasting appearance of these three groups of objects thus manifested separate connections with the realm of death on the one hand and with the human world with the other hand. The third and the last section, Confucian vision, dynastic time in words and images. The practice of burying sacrificial vessels, utensils, and spirit articles in graves had existed long before the late 4th century BCE. What is special about King Cuo's tomb is an effort to synthesize previous ritual conventions, practice, to group ritual projects, objects, into discrete yet complementary categories, and to orchestrate a complex ritual display based on an articulated rationale. We recognize this rationale from the consciously selected materials, designs, and locations for tomb furnishings. In terms of their placement, inside the two chambers in King Cuo's tomb, the three categories of objects were positioned in different spaces according to their diverse functions and symbolism. The two inscribed bronzes, for example, formed part of a display in a restricted area in the west chamber, possibly constituting an area to evoke ancestor worship. The luxury utilitarian objects were concentrated in the east chamber, the other one. It's now here. Then the ghostly black spirit articles were scattered everywhere except for the area of ancestral worship. So once again, we find a textual counterpart of this combination of three distinct categories of objects in the Confucian ritual discourse. According to Yi Li, Asket and Rites, this is another main book of Confucian school, Rujia. So while tomb of low-ranking officers were furnished only with a spirit article and the lived objects, a high-level burial, such as this one, should also be equipped with sacrificial vessels previously housed in the family temple. So again, we find this basically contemporary writing on ritual objects, and here the practice is really display. There is a very interesting dialogue between these two kinds of activities. The systematic design of the tomb and its implied rationality suggests the direct involvement of Confucian ritualists. This possibility is confirmed by both transmitted and newly excavated texts, which demonstrate the strong presence of the Ru school in Zhongshan and a strong Confucian influence on the state official ideology. Strategy of the Warring States, a book compiled between the 3rd and 1st century BCE, states that rulers of Zhongshan single-mindedly practiced the doctrine of benevolence and righteousness and honor the Confucian learning. This record is substantiated by the lengthy inscriptions on King Chuo's sacrificial vessels, which derive many literary expressions from key Confucian texts. Fundamental virtues held by the Ru school, such as benevolence, righteousness, and integrity, are stressed over and over in the inscriptions, just as honoring the worthy, Shangxian, honoring worthies, is held as a king's primary duty. The same text, The Strategies of the Warring States, also contains a passage which criticized Zhongshan rulers for their support of scholars who pursued names instead of substance, clearly referring to the Confucian doctrine called rectifying names. This doctrine is an essential component of Confucius' teaching. It is recorded in the Analects that in responding to an inquiry about the most urgent matter in instituting good governance, Confucius said, quote, "What must be done is to rectify name, because if names be not rectified, language is not in accordance with the truth of things. If language be not in accordance with truth of things, affairs cannot be carried on to success. When affairs cannot be carried on to success, ritual and music do not flourish." Rectifying names is therefore intrinsically connected to the Confucian project of defining rites and ritual objects. The distinct nomenclature of King Chuo's tomb furnishing, Sheng Qi or lived objects formerly used by him, Ji Qi or sacrificial vessels transferred from his ancestral temples, and the Ming Qi or spirit articles designed for the tombs, resulted from the operation of this doctrine in mortuary art. Whereas these terms of names constituted the first systematical classification of manufactured forms in China, they also encouraged the creative impulse to articulate different styles and different visual effects in making actual works of art. Central to the current discussion on dynastic time in artistic practice and discourse, the three categories of artifacts in Chuo's tomb indexed different historical periods. The black pottery vessels resurrected the tradition of prehistoric Longshan pottery. The inscribed sacrificial bronzes revived Western Zhou ritual art. And the lavish utilitarian objects reflected the contemporary taste for extravagance. These temporal associations remind us of the succinct dynastic sequences of ritual art prescribed in Confucian ritual texts, in which divergent materials, forms, and colors are correlated with successive dynasties in the past. Most of these mini histories of ritual and material culture come from the Tan Gong chapter in the Book of Rites. Tan Gong chapter in yellow, which modern scholars have dated to the mid-Warring States period or the 4th century BCE. It is interesting to find in this text that while devoting themselves to construct dynastic sequences of ritual customs, members of the Ru school also debated about the meaning of these practices and how to use them for current needs. There are examples. For example, we read a conversation between two chief disciples of Confucius named Yuan Xian and Zeng Shen concerning the historical symbolism of funerary objects. So Yuan Xian made a proposed that when furnishing tombs, people of the Xia dynasty only use spirit articles to signify the dead's lack of consciousness. People of the Shang Dynasty used sacrificial vessels instead, because in their view, the dead retain consciousness. And people of the Zhou combined both methods because they thought the dead could be either conscious or unconscious. So Zeng Shan and the other disciple disagreed with this interpretation, but actually concurred with Yuan Xian, the first person, concurred with him about the historical classification of these vessel types. So there are a lot of discussion going on. So rather than a purely intellectual exercise, such a classification, periodization of ritual objects enabled members of Ru school to design ritual performance and display. In other words, through reconstructing ritual customs of the three dynasties, these Confucian ritualists saw themselves as the guardians of authentic ritual codes, which they then used to design contemporary ritual affairs. The Tangong chapter, the same chapter, offers plenty of such examples, including the funeral rites for Confucius himself, which was designed by his disciple named Gongsun Chi, who was known for his extensive knowledge in ritual regulation. Yes. According to this text, this Gongsun Chi, who designed the Confucius the Master's funeral, he followed the Zhou Dynasty custom, decorating the coffin with wall-like curtains, fan-like screens, and cords at its sides, very detailed. He also set up flags with tooth edge after the manner of Shang Dynasty. The flag staffs were bound with white silk and long streamers after the manner of Xia Dynasty. This eclectic or synthetic way of designing a funeral leads us back to King Cuo's tomb. Constructed at the very end of 4th century BCE, its date is close to that of the Tangong chapter. Our discussion has shown that, like Confucius' funeral, as reported in the Book of Rites, this tomb also combined the funeral customs attributed to the three dynasties. Moreover, when archaeologists opened this tomb, they found that its interior had a complex color scheme. The walls were painted white, red pigment covered the surface of bronze vessels, and the pottery spirit articles were all shiny black. We are again reminded the passage from the Tangong chapter, under the sovereign of the Xia Dynasty, they preferred what is black. Under the Shang Dynasty, they preferred what was white. Under the Zhou Dynasty, they preferred what was red. So what we discovered here is a tomb which synthesized the discrete moments in a diachronic history of ritual objects into a synchronic spatial construct. As a result, the tomb came to inherit all the virtues of the three dynasties and became in itself a monument or embodiment of dynastic time. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art production.